Good morning. I hope everyone has a packet. We're going to go through this together. So our topic for today is Live and Let Live, the Torah's protest against a warfare mentality in Sefer Devarim. Sefer Devarim, Parshat Shoftim, actually, we find the biblical laws related to warfare. Parshat Ki Tetzeh continues that with the laws about the captured woman, but the main laws about war are found in Parshat Shoftim, in Parak Chaf, chapter 20 of Sefer Devarim. The placement of military laws in Sefer Devarim is appropriate and very sensible, since the entire book of Devarim is Moshe's speeches preparing the Jewish people for their life in Israel. He's giving these farewell addresses on the plains of Moab, Arvot Moab, the eastern bank of the Jordan River, right before he dies. And in these last remarks, Moshe prepares the nation for the months and years ahead, which will be full of fighting and full of wars as they conquer the lands from the seven nations, the Canaanim, the nations living in Israel, who are dwelling there beforehand. As we look through these psukim in Parakhlas, we have to ask a local and a global question. Local, our specific question is going to be, what laws does Moshe teach pertaining to war? What are the laws that Moshe feels are important to address and prepare B'nai Israel in chapter 20 of Sefer Devarim? And our overarching and our global question is going to be, what outlook towards war does God want to impart to this nation on the eve of their battle preparations? In other words, what are the lessons to be drawn out from these specific laws? Let us take a look together at the first unit of war laws and explain what each one in isolation, and then try to see if there's a common theme and thread that applies to them all. So we look first at the section. This is source number one on your source sheets. Parak Chaf, Sukkim, Aleph until Chaf, 1 through 20 in chapter 20. The section begins, Ki Tetzeh LaMelchama, when you go out to war, clearly outlining that the laws to follow are all about wartime laws. Each subsequent section begins with the same word, ki. If you notice, we have three separate parshiot. A parshia is a paragraph that's created in the Tanakh and the Torah with these little spaces. So you see these little brackets at the end of Pasuk Tet, for example, there's a samach with the brackets. That's telling you it's a parshia stuma. It's a closed space. We have another closed space, stuma, after pasuk yudchet, and we have an open space, a parshia pitucha, after pasuk chaf. So what the Torah is doing, it is basically writing a really good essay where you make each topic a separate paragraph. A topic that's all related isn't going to be one paragraph, and a new topic will be in the next paragraph. So what we see here is that we have three distinct topics in chapter 20. Each one begins with the phrase key, and telling us about a different situation that arises during war as its own self-contained topic. Notice, though, at the end of Pasuk Chaf, we have a Parshia Petucha, an open space, probably marking for the next topic a totally different topic. I mean, a smaller space, it's like kind of like a paragraph break, but an open space perhaps would be like a new page break, you know, equivalent to writing a paper. A new topic completely, perhaps beginning in Pasuk, after Pasuk Chaf, which is actually about the law of Eglah Rufa. So each section begins with the phrase ki, and we can look at how each one is therefore described to us as a temporal phrase or casuistic formula, which means when this situation occurs, you shall do this. And it's not written in a apodictic formulation, which would be thou shalt, right? Tetzeh lamelchama, but here it's ki tetzeh lamelchama, when you go out to war. And our next paragraph begins, ki tikrav al ir lehilachem, when you go out to war to fight against a city, and pasuk yotet ki tatsur al ir gamim, when you besiege a city. Let's look now at the topic of each one. So the first section is Aleph through Tet. Those psukim are about the pre-war speeches given to the army to get them ready for battle. So it begins, ki tetzeh lamelchama al oyvecha, tells about the situation. When you go out to war and you see all these horses and chariots that are maybe stronger and mightier from you, don't be afraid. Then it goes through the two speeches, we'll go through carefully and slowly in a minute. And it tells you that at the end of this section that you will, the officers will appoint officers over the army and basically getting you ready to fight. The second section is about when you want to fight a city, you first must call out for it in peace, and then it goes to the conditions about who you're allowed to kill during war, which people, what you're allowed to do during the wartime, how you're supposed to treat the enemy which you are fighting. And the third section deals with when you are besieging a city,
What are you not allowed to do? And specifically, not about destroying fruit-bearing trees during the time of a matsur, during the time of a siege. As we go through these psukim, I just want to give a disclaimer, not just give credit. A lot of what we're going to talk about today is from the writings of Rav David Tzvi Hoffman. He wrote a commentary to Sefer Dvarim. Rav David Tzvi Hoffman was a rabbi who lived in Berlin. He was a rabbi, he lived from 1843, he died in 1921, lived in Germany. He was at one point the head of Hildesheimer Yeshiva in Germany. And he's a reputable Talmud Chacham, but also I dabbled a little bit in Bible criticism and, you know, knew, well, we're going to bring some other interesting sources in today, like Josephus, and I got those sources from reading Rav David Tzvi Hoffman. So we're going to start off by looking at the first part of the parak, the pre-war speech section, Psukim Aleph through 10. Again, our goal is to understand what is being said in each section, our three sections of Sefer Devarim Parak Chaf, but then our ultimate goal is to try to tease out what is the underlying message and lesson that continues through each of these sections together. That forms a common theme of this parak and perhaps war in general. So let's start off by looking at these pre-war speeches. Pasuk Aleph gives us an introduction. When you go out to war, don't be afraid, because God, who took you out of Mitzrayim, is with you. You should not be afraid. It's interesting that it says, Ki Hashem lechecha imach hamlecha meretz Mitzrayim, that God who brought you out of Mitzrayim, probably very deliberate use of that term, meaning tells us in the Pasuk, don't be afraid of Rechev and Sus and these chariots and horses. So therefore, why should I not be scared of chariots and horses? Because God has destroyed chariots and horses beforehand, namely when he took us out of Egypt. At Kriyat Yam Suf, or with all the Makot, God destroyed the Egyptian army. So therefore, that's our precedent. Don't be afraid now, because God has done this for you beforehand. When you get close to the battle, the Kohen will come close, and he will approach, and he will speak to the nation. So we see that our first speaker is the Kohen. His remarks are from Pasuk Gimel until Pasuk Dalet. Okay? Pasuk Hey, we see, V'dibru ha-shotrim. The officers give the next speech. And their speech begins in Pasuk Hey, Mi ha-ish. Goes through a list of people who are exempt from war. And his speech ends at the end of Pasuk Chet, V'lo yimas elevat echad bilvavo. So we see, therefore, we have two pre-war speeches given before every battle. The first one is given over by the priest. The Gemara talks about which priest is the one who gives it over, one who's appointed for this role. Is it the Kohen Gadol? Is it the Kohen Mashuach Melchama? And the second speech is presented and given off by the officers, the Shotrim. So besides even just the fact that we have different speakers, the content of these speeches are also very different from one another. The first speech tells us, we'll look inside together, Pasuk Gimel, Shema Yisrael, which is a common phrase in Sefer Dvarim. Listen up, Bnei Israel. Atem kerevim hayom milchama al oyveichem. You guys are approaching war today against your enemies. Al yirach levavchem, al tiru, v'al techpezu, v'al taritzu mifneihem. Notice the language of four times telling you, do not be afraid, do not panic, do not be scared, do not have dread. Ki Hashem elokechem ha'olechim achem, because God is with you. V'lachem lachem, to fight against your enemies. Im oyveichem loshiatchem. This is familiar from davening. God is with you. God's going to fight your battle for you. In fact, these words echo Moshe's remarks in Pasuk Aleph. Moshe was giving off the speech in Pasuk Aleph. He's telling you the exact same thing. Don't be afraid. So the Kohen is just echoing what Moshe himself said. All future speeches, the Kohen's going to remark and say, don't be afraid. God fights your wars for you. When I look at the Shotrim speech, it's very different in terms of content. V'dibru ha-shotrim ela amlei mor, this is Pasuk Hei, mi ha-ish asher bana bayit chadash v'lo chancho. Who amongst you built a house and you didn't get to live in it, you didn't get to inaugurate it? Yelech v'yashu l'beito, go home to your house. Pen yamu b'milchama v'ish acher yechanchenu. Because lest you die in battle, and somebody else will go and dwell and inaugurate your home. Similarly, mi ha-ish asher nata kerem, who here amongst you planted a vineyard? And you did not harvest it. Go home to your house. Because lest you die in battle, and somebody else will now get to reap the benefit of your vineyard. That's Pasuk Zayin. Umi ha'ish asher aras isha v'lo l'kacha. Who here got engaged to a woman but did not yet marry her? Go home to your house. Again, pen yamupa milchama v'isha acher yikachana. Lest you die in war and somebody else goes and marries your wife. V'yasofu ha-shotrim v'daber el-am v'yomer v'yomru mi ha-ish ha-yarei v'rach ha-leivav yelech v'yashav eto. And the last exemption is someone who's scared, let him go home to his house v'lo yimas levav achav levavo, and let him not melt the hearts of his brothers like his own heart. This describes four people who are exempt from battle. A person who built a house, a person who planted a vineyard, a person who got engaged, and a person who is just regular, afraid of battle, perhaps. So how do these two speeches relate to one another? They seem to have very, very different content. One's a psych-up speech. Don't worry, guys. God's going to win your battles for you. Everything's going to be awesome. And the next speech is, go home, go home, go home. How do these two speeches relate to one another? And I think we can look at the relationship between these two speeches in two completely different ways. On the one hand, one can say that these two speeches complement each other, but just in opposite ways. Both speeches are trying to build the confidence and the morale of the army. The first speech in a positive way, pumping them up, God's going to fight for us. And the second speech, in a negative way, gets rid of any people who would make other people fearful. Perhaps the people not affected by the Kohen speech are told to go home and to leave the army. But what's left remaining are the people who are going to all be psyched up, ready to fight, because they were inspired by the Kohen speech. On the other hand, though, these two speeches do seem to contradict each other. The first speech says, don't be afraid, don't be scared. And the second speech says, you might die, you should be scared. The Kohen speaks about how God's going to keep us safe, while the Shochim speak about the fear that people are going to die during war. If one takes a look at the Ramban on source number 3, he discusses this inherent contradiction between these two speeches. We're going to start, actually, we'll go back to the beginning part a little bit later. We start with the Omar Lohoshiatcham. It's 5 lines down. Shehem yinatzlu bemelchama velo yifko mehem ish. It almost sounds like, from the Kohen speech, pumping them up, we're going to be successful, we're going to win, it sounds like no one's going to die. When you're listening to Cohen's speech, he's telling you, don't be afraid, God's fighting our wars. Sounds miraculous, sounds like every single person will survive. But in reality, when you fight wars against enemies, the reality of the world is that there are casualties even on the side of the victors. Even on the winning side, people suffer casualties. That's why Yoshua was so upset when 36 people died in his battle against Ai, because he assumed that if he's fighting a war and God's on their side, then nobody should have died. Because in his battle, that was a mechamet mitzvah, we'll define that term very soon, but at a war which God commands, nobody is supposed to die. Not a hair is supposed to fall off their head. Ki la Hashem ha-melchama, because God is fighting the battle. V'nei ha-kohen shehu ha-ovedat Hashem yasiram b'yaratov v'yavticham. So the Kohen, who represents God on earth, he's telling about God's battle. And in God's battle, nobody should die. Aval ha-shotrim, but on the other hand, the officers who represent all wars, regular battles, mundane wars that everyone fights, Yizabru b'nohek sheba olam. They speak about the reality of the world. And reality is, there are casualties even on the winning side. So what Ramban is describing is this dichotomy, that the Kohen speaks about a religious war, which is not fought really in the ideal war, which is not a reality war, where no one should be dying. But the Shotrim speak about a typical war, a real war, where there are casualties in battle. Which speech do you think should come first? Just one second. Which speech do you think should come first, based on what we're saying here? Or even if, you know, that the Shotrim speak about exemptions, and the Kohen's giving you this psych-up that this battle is fought by God, and therefore just trust in Hashem to be successful. It seems to make sense that actually the Shotrim speech should come first. Shouldn't I first get my army together, have all people who are exempt go home, and then give a nice pump-up speech? Giving a pump-up speech and then having all these different people walk away seems to kind of detract from the purpose of it. It's actually interesting, the Gemara is sensitive to this. If you look at source number 2, and the Gemara actually inverses the order of our speeches, changes the order of the pshat, so to speak. Tanu Rabbanan, pa'amayim midaber imahem, says that the Kohen spoke to the nation twice. Achat b'sapar v'achat b'melchama. The Kohen spoke to them once at the border, before getting ready for war, meaning like while they're still preparing, making their preparations for war. V'achad ha-milchama, and one right before battle. B'sapar mahu amar, at the border, meaning while they're still getting ready, what did he tell them? Shimuna devari, merkei ha-milchama v'chizru. First he gave them the exemptions, telling them to go home. Notice you can read this word as two ways. You can read it as v'chizru, as lashon sivoy, you have to go home, or v'chazru, and they will return. Just describing the events, meaning, we'll discuss this later on, but the people, do they have to go home? Or is it optional for them to go home? And I think this gemara can be read either way. Ba'melchama mahu omer, what does the Kohen say at war itself? Al yirach levavchem, al tiru v'al techbazu v'al taritzu. This first speech. What the Gemara is telling us is that the Kohen gave two speeches. First, he told people to go home. Let's get the army prepared. Let's get rid of all those people who should not be fighting. And then right on the eve of battle, right before they're about to fight, then he gave the pump-up speech. So notice, this Gemara is inverting the speeches that we found, the order found in the Psukim. And also, this Gemara is based on a later Gemara that actually says that the Kohen said actually both speeches. In our Psukim, it sounds like the Kohen gave the pump-up speech, and the Shotrim gave the exemption speech. According to Chazal, the Kohen did both, but that the Shotrim repeated the exemption speech. So this is what Chazal view. And actually, Rashi quotes this in Pasuk Chet, by Yosifu HaShotrim, which is source number 5, where Chazal believed that the Kohen first gave over the exemption speech, and the Shotrim repeated it. The last exemption, the Shotrim said by themselves, and repeated it themselves, while the pump-up speech, the Kohen said it, and he repeated it. Perhaps support for why the Torah would change the order could be that, again, we saw that the Kohen's speech echoes whose words? Moshe's words. In Pasuk Aleph, Moshe says, you're going out to war, don't be afraid, God's fighting for you. So perhaps the Chumash wants to put the Kohen's speech next to Moshe's, so that Moshe's words, so that we see there's the very similarity between them. That being the case, again, it's not textually rooted that we would invert these speeches like Chazal do say, but it certainly makes sense based on content. First, get rid of people who are not going to fight, and then give your big pump-up speech right before there's about to be battle. Let's now look at the actual exemptions in this speech, in the second of the speeches. Are these four exemptions the same, or is the fourth entirely different? As I was reading them, hopefully you guys noticed that the first three sounded so similar. Who is the man who did X? Let him go home, because we don't want lest he die in battle, and somebody else will get to finish what this man started. While the fourth one does sound very different. Who is the man who is fearful? Doesn't have the exact same language as the first three who are exempt. That being the case, we're going to first look at Mefarshim, who lump all four people who are exempt together, and then we'll look at a Parshan based on the Midrash that actually separates and looks at the first three as one unit, and the last one as a different category. The first two Mefarshim that we're going to look at that lump them all together are the Ramban and the Rashbam. Meaning, they see that these four people are part of the same entity, and that's why they're being sent home. But they understand that in very different ways. I think it's very interesting. The Ramban sees these four people as a potential danger to the army. Someone who built a house, who hasn't yet lived in it. Someone who planted a vineyard, who hasn't yet reap the benefits of his vineyard, a person who got engaged, and a person who is fearful. Look at the Ramban we read before. We're going to look at now the last line. This is source number 3, where he says, "V'tziva al shlosha eila." He's describing the first three, but we'll see that he's specifically referring to the fourth one as well. Lashuv, we tell these three people to go home again: the house, the vineyard, and the person who's engaged. Kilibo al Beitove Karmo the Al Sho. His mind is on his house, on his vineyard, on his newly engaged wife, right? His fiance, Vianus. That's very important. He's scared. We are scared that these people, because their mind is elsewhere, what are they gonna do? They're gonna flee. They're gonna run away during battle. They're gonna act cowardly by actually leaving the battle because their mind is elsewhere. They wanna be with those things that they're involved with. It can be disastrous effect of the army, right? One of the worst offenses in any army is that a soldier can commit is becoming a deserter. And the Ramban says that all these four people, the person who's scared, obviously, he's the one obviously from the Psukim says that we're scared he's going to melt the hearts of others. Well, how would he melt the hearts of others? By running away. And the other three, although it couches it as terms like we are scared that somebody else will enjoy it, it's not that we really care about that individual and his psychology, but we care about him being a good soldier. And if he runs away, that would be disastrous. That would be horrible for the rest of the soldiers. We can't have somebody fleeing and being a deserter during a time of battle. The Rashbam, on the other hand, views it very differently. Like the Ramban, he also views all four exemptions in the same under one heading, but completely different. So the Rashbam is source number four. So first he explains to us, Yelech v'yashuv leveito, im yerach levavo v'yarei mazlo. What's going on with this person? The person who built a house, the person who planted a vineyard, the person who's engaged, this person's probably thinking the following. Oh man, it's just my luck. I just built this house. I just planted this vineyard and I just got engaged. Now I have to go to battle. It's just my luck. What's going to happen to me? I'm going to die. And I'm not going to go home and live in my house. I'm not going to home and reap the benefits of my vineyard. And I'm not going to home and get married to this woman who I want to marry. It's just going to happen to me because that's my luck. I'm the person who never wins any raffles. It's just so like me that this is going to happen to me. That's what the person's thinking. So the Rashbam explains, Shayesh no tain ali bo kishaholecha milchama vedoeg shema eli mazal lechanich hebeti, o et ishti, o et karmi, ulakach garamaz li lelechat atza lemilchama, umitokach yarelamut. Exactly what we said. This person is just thinking, this is just my luck. It's going to happen to me that I'm in the middle of this great process. I'm in the middle of doing something so important. I'm looking forward to the conclusion of all these things, one of these things, and it's just going to happen to me that I'm going to be the one to die and not to get home, not to be able to reap the benefits of what I'm in the middle of doing. The Rashbam is actually borrowing a term. He's describing something that Rashi himself quotes. So look on the next page. We should look at a phrase in Rashi. Rashi on Pasuk Hey, Velo Chancho. The last line he says, V'diber v'davar shel agmat nefesh huzeh. Agmat nefesh is the idea of like personal affliction. This person is thinking, I built this house, I didn't get to live in it yet. That's a psychological hardship for somebody, to be in the middle of something and not let them finish it. Rashbam is describing this. For the person who we feel is internally going to be suffering, we want them to go home. Why? Not because we're scared they're going to become deserters, and not because we think they're going to be bad soldiers, but for another reason. So the last two lines of Rashbam, V'shulsha ma'asim hizkir, bayit isha v'kerem, ulvasof kolel kol hadvarim. How does the Rashbam understand the fourth exemption? It's not a new category, but rather it's a summary of the first three categories. The first three categories were merely examples of a larger idea. Someone who just feels like they're in the middle of a process of life, and they want to finish it. The last line is not a new category, but anyone, for any other reason, let's say you just adopted a dog, and you want some time with your dog. That would fit under the category, according to the Rashbam. Any example that would fit under this example of someone in the middle of a life process, or someone who's just especially wanting to finish something, we would let that person go home. Ulvasof kolel kol hazvarim, mia ish hayarei v'rach halevav. Bein ve'elu she'amarnu, bein bevarim acharim. If it fits in the first three specifically, great, but if it's a different type of example, that also would work. Stan gives you an example where Tanakh does this. V'chein b'kohelet, mone gimel dvarim, v'chozer v'kolel, ma yitron l'adam. This is the style of the Torah. I might give three specific examples, and my fourth one is supposed to be like the catch-all phrase. So too here. I tell you about the person who built a house, person who planted a vineyard, a person who got engaged, but anybody else who would also be afraid of dying because they're in the middle of a life process, or they have this agmat nefesh, this internal suffering, we would let that person go home. So notice our differences between the Rashbam and the Rambam. Again, they both lump all four exemptions together. It's one big umbrella. For the Rashbam, it's anybody who has this personal suffering because they're in the middle of a life process or they want to go home to finish something. And for the Ramban, it's anyone who wants to go home and therefore we're scared they're going to flee. I think we can apply a halachic term to our discussion of the Rashbam and the Ramban. We can kind of ask ourselves, what's the nafka mina between these approaches? What's the practical difference between the Rashbam approach, that we care about the individual, versus the Ramban, that we're scared he's going to flee? The first difference is, perhaps, is this exemption mandatory or optional? I alluded to that earlier. Must this person leave, or can he leave? For the Ramban, what would you guys say? We're scared he's going to flee. So can he stay? No. The exemption is 100% mandatory. You must go home. The Rashbam, I think maybe you could argue about it. It's not so clear. If it's because we care about this person's individual and we care about his internal suffering, maybe if the guy wants to, like, I don't know, deal with it and, you know, take one for the team. He wants to go through it, and maybe we let him stay. But you could argue and say that even for the Rashbam, it's mandatory because of the last phrase of the last exemption, number 4, back to Pasuk Chet, V'lo yimas levad achav kilvavo. Maybe we're still scared of his fear, of his bad luck, or maybe perhaps scared that it might impact and influence others, and it may cause others to be fearful as well. Interesting that Chazal actually viewed it as not optional, it's 100% mandatory, these exemptions. Although for Chazal, you have to prove that you are exempt, you have to prove that you built a new house, you have to prove that you planted a new karem. But if you look at the Sifri, it's quoted in Rashi on Pasuk Zion. The Sifri is pretty bold in what it says. It says, Pen Yamut Milchama, lest he die in battle. Yashuv Pen Yamut, he has to go home lest he die. She'im lo yishma ledivrei ha-kohen, if he doesn't listen to the words of the Kohen, kadai hu she'yamut, then he should die. So Chazal is like, no, go home. We don't want you in this battle. If you don't listen to us, then a little bit of a death warrant, a little bit on your head. It's on you. Who do we care about? And I think the second nafka mina between the Rashbam and the Ramban is, who do we care about? I mean, this is the most important nafka mina between them. Who do we care about? Do we care about the individual soldier? Or do we care about the army and the war, what's going on at the big picture? The Ramban, we care about the army. We care about the battle. And therefore, we send people home who are not going to be good soldiers, who would flee and therefore cause detrimental effect on the rest of the army and perhaps lose the war for us. If you look actually at an interesting source, is Josephus. This is source number 6. Again, I got this from Rav David Tzvi Hoffman, and then I went back and then quoted him in the original. Josephus, the historian, describes also what happened before war. This is what I'll give you. We'll read the quote together. Do you also give leave to those who have already lately built them houses and have not yet lived in them in years time, and to those that have planted them vineyards and have not yet partakers of their fruits to continue in their own country, as well as those who have betrothed or lately married them wives, lest they have such an affection for these things that they too sparing of their lives and by reserving themselves for these enjoyments, they become voluntary cowards on account of their wives. Notice, he also blurs all 4 exemptions, people who are exempt together, the house, the vineyard, the betrothal, and the person who's scared, like Ramban. And you also see them as not being good for the army like Ramban, but he actually has a very different reason why. For Josephus, it's not that we're scared they're going to flee and become deserters, but for Josephus, it's that they're going to act too cautious because of fear of missing out on these things. Therefore, they won't make good soldiers because they're not ready to die. They're not going to make the right calculations during battle. I don't know, they won't jump on a grenade because they're not going to put their lives at risk because they want to go home to these things. So it's similar to Ramban in that not good soldiers, but for a different reason. Not because they're going to flee, because they're going to kind of make bad choices during battle. A good soldier has to be someone who's willing to die during battle. And these people are not always willing to die, and therefore they're not going to make the right, they're not going to act accordingly. But we see, therefore, that the Ramban, Josephus, it's all concerned for the army. I don't care, per se, about this individual person's life. I care about how he's going to impact the rest of my soldiers, the group, the military as a whole. On the other hand, Rashbam demonstrates a concern about the individual. We care about his concerns. We care about what's going on internally inside of him. How's he feeling? And if we feel like he's suffering internally, we don't want him to be in our army. But I'm looking out for his best interest, not for the interest of the battle. I'm caring about the individual. And I think it's so surprising that a pre-war speech would look out for the interest of the individual, of the yachid, and not the army as a whole. And this is where Rav David Tzvi Hoffman concludes from the pre-war speeches that he gives us a little bit of a harmonization approach here, where he tries to argue and say that the first 3 exemptions are for the good of the individual. That's like the Rashbam, we care about him. But the last exemption, that's for the entire army. Because the language is different. And I want to just show you some support for that in the Psukim. I think Rashi is similar to that as well. Rashi, on the other hand, will differentiate between exemption 4 and the first 3. And this differentiation really does make a lot of sense in the Psukim. Right? The first three people who are exempt, the house, the vineyard, and the betrothed man, they all have the exact same language of Mi ha'ish, who is the man who's in the middle of something? Yelech v'yashuv, let him go home. Pen yamu b'milchama, lest he die in battle, and somebody else gets to complete that. My fourth exemption does not have that same language at all. My fourth exemption says, where are we? Pasuk chet. Miha'ish, I start with who's the man, but Hayareva Rachleva, Yelech Yashiv Leveto. I don't have the language of Pen Yamut, the Ishacher. I don't have the language of lest he die and somebody else take over. Here referring to him, he's scared of battle, let him not make other people fearful. And plus the reason given for the Batur is very different. It's not, I don't want him to die because I want someone else to finish it for him, but rather, I don't want him to melt the hearts of others. And that's where David's behalf and perhaps sees that the first three I care about the individual, but the last one my concern is for the army, for the group, for Tovat HaMilchama, as he calls it, versus Tovat HaYachid. How does Rashi therefore explain now differences between the first three exemptions and the last exemption, if there is a difference between them? So let's take a look at Rashi. Rashi is source number 5. And we're looking at Rashi on Pasuk Chet. Vayosifu hashotrim. Lama ne'amar kan vayosifu. Mosifin al divrei hakohen. They add on to the Kohen speech. Actually, we talked about this Rashi already outside. We're going to look at the next one, two lines down. Hayarei v'rach levav. Rashi goes for us a machlok between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yossi Haglili about our fourth exempt person. Right? The first three we said are people who are in the middle of a life process. Rashi says we care about their agmat nefesh, their internal suffering, and therefore we care about them as individuals. But this fourth the fourth person who's exempt, the person who's fearful, there are two different ways to look at it in the Midrash. Rabbi Akiva Omer kimashma'o. The way we should interpret this fourth exemption is according to the Pshat. She'eina yachol la'amod b'kishrei ha'melchama ulerot char shufa. This person is really just scared of battle. He can't stand war, perhaps blood and guts. He can't handle seeing spears and swords. It's interesting that Rashi views this as somebody who can't handle, it sounds like he can't handle, what do you guys think? Killing people or being killed? Or both? Both? So there are some of Farshim who actually interpret as he doesn't want to kill others. This one makes it sound like he doesn't want to, I think probably be killed. He's very just nervous about, you know, blood and guts. But you can, you know, how do you read tender of heart? Is that he can't handle blood and guts in general, or he can't handle inflicting punishment and pain on somebody else? So Akiva understands this as, according to the plain sense of the verse, this person is scared of battle, scared of dying or killing others. But Rabbi Yossi HaGlili Omer, Hayare Me'averot Shebiyado. Rabbi Yossi HaGlili seems to give a out of left field answer, where he says he's scared of sins. He's scared of his own sins that he committed. L'kach taltat Torah l'chazor al bayit v'karim v'isha l'chasot ahachozrim shebishvil avirot shebiyadam. And now Rabbi Yossi HaGlili views the first three exemptions as a cover-up. This fourth person is scared of sins that he committed. So the Torah, Rashi uses the word of, it hangs his exemption on the previous three exemptions, meaning the house, the vineyard, the betrothed woman are just a kind of cover-up. So when I send people out for war because they really have sins, other people won't be pointing and say, oh, look at Shmuley over there. He must have done something terrible. He's a sinner. But instead, he might say, oh, maybe Shmuley built a house. Maybe Shmuley planted a vineyard. Maybe Shmuley got engaged. What I really want to avoid, according to Yosef Lili, is people who sinned in my army. And I just kind of like, to make the person feel better, give him other three outs that other people won't look at him negatively and see him as a sinner. But what I really don't want is him to come to my battle if he has sins. And exactly what we said, someone who sees this person leaving the battlefield won't immediately think he's a sinner, but they might think he went home for the other reasons explained in the psukim. So while at first glance Rabbi Yossi's opinion seems to be far-fetched, I think it makes a lot of sense in the psukim, especially in light of the first speech. If we go back to our first speech, what did the Kohen promise us? The Kohen promises us, Ki Hashem Elokeichem Ha'alechim Achem Lilachem Lachem Imoyveichem Loshiyatchem. The Kohen promises us you will be successful. And now to go back to that first Ramban that I skipped the first four lines on source number 3. He explains it very beautifully. After that little dash, the Kohen is telling them not to be scared, not to be afraid of the enemy. Don't rely on your strength. Don't think you're winning because you're strong or you're mighty warriors. What does God tell us He wants? Therefore, if I'm fighting a battle for you, I want you to be believers in me. It's not about how strong you are or how the world describes you as mighty warriors. But what I care about is if you direct your attention towards me, God. If you trust that the salvation will come from me. Quote from Tehillim, that God cares about not how many horses we have, not in the might of men, but God cares about if we put our trust in Him. If that's the case, if the first speech is all about put trust in God, what makes a good soldier in God's eyes? It's not the person who's mighty, strong, and tough, but it's a person who's committed to God and trusts in God. So then Rabbi Yossi Aglieli is perhaps arguing that the only patur we really care about is sending home sinners. We can't have them in our army, because if we have them in our army, we can't be guaranteed about God's salvation. We can't be guaranteed the God's promise of victory. Think back to that example about Yeshua and Ai. Why did 36 people die in the battle of Ai? It's not because they weren't tough enough, it's not because they didn't practice and they didn't drill themselves before, but because Achan, one man, was a sinner. Our battles are fought differently than mundane natural battles, as the Ramban outlines us in the beginning, Ramban, about the two different speeches. And since our battles aren't won by our might alone, it's only because God is on our side. The main criteria for our soldiers is that they should be faithful servants of God. And therefore, the only exemption that we really, really want are people to leave the army who committed a sin and therefore perhaps don't have the utmost faith in God, and therefore the nation won't be guaranteed God's protection and they won't win the battle. Okay. Source number 7 now discusses, when do these exemptions actually occur? This is going to lead us to our next part of the parak. According to Chazal, number 7, Bamed Dvarim Amurim, Bamelchamet Rishut. These exemptions, these four people who are exempt, only applies during a voluntary war. Aval Melchamet Mitzvah, Bamelchamot Mitzvah, Hakol Yotzin. But in obligatory wars, wars that God commands, everybody has to go out to war. And this, we have this famous quote, Afilu Chatan Mechadro, Bekala Mechupata. Even a groom from his chamber and a kala from her chupa would have to go out and fight, or at least the kala would probably give provisions at the battlefield. So what the Gemara is telling us is that the second speech in our first section would only be given before a milchamet rishut, before an optional war, but during a mandatory war, everyone has to fight. Interesting, Book of Maccabees gives over the speech. Look at this, it's an interesting quote. This is Judah Maccabee preparing his troops, ready for his battle, one of the battles, and this is what he said. After this, Judas appointed captains over the people, over thousands, over hundreds, over fifties, over tens. That's appointing the shotrim, the officers. And he said to them, that were building houses or had betrothed wives or were planting vineyards or were fearful, that they should return every man to his house according to the law. Notice he's quoting from Sefer Dvar, the four people who are exempt, telling they should go home. The problem is, Judah Maccabee's war was with a Mechamet Mitzvah or Mechamet Rishut. So, not so clear, we have to go through some of our discussion, what is a Mechamet Mitzvah, what is Mechamet Rishut, but most Mefarshim do say that a defensive war, where we are being attacked and therefore we want to defend ourselves, would be a Mechamet Mitzvah. So the most Mefarshim explain that the period of history when the Jews were fighting the Syrian Greeks would probably be defined as a Mechamet Mitzvah. So how is Judah Maccabee sending these people home then? The Gemara just said during Mechamet Mitzvah, everyone has to go. So just how he deals with this. Rav David Tzvi Hoffman explains, maybe Yehuda Maccabee, maybe he was a great warrior, maybe he wasn't such a Talmud Chacham, maybe he didn't know the Halacha. That's one response he says. Or, he says that perhaps, maybe only the Mechamet Mitzvah, where everyone has to fight, is the Mechamet Mitzvah found in Sefer Dvarim, the Mechamet Mitzvah of conquering the land of Israel. Maybe only that battle everyone had to fight, and maybe future Mechamot Mitzvah, and included within that defensive wars, maybe there would be exemptions. Okay. Now let's turn to our next part of the speech. Or just to wrap up the pre-war speeches, what we see here is that The Torah presents a non-war mentality, I think, really in two ways. The Kohen's words of faith are really emphasizing our battles are won by God and God alone. It's not about the strength of our army. It's not about how many chariots we have. It's not about how strong our soldiers are. But as the Ramban explains, it's to man to rely on God's deliverance and God alone. The second part where we see an anti or a non-war mentality is in the second part of the exemption speech. The exemption speech, where we have this concern for the individual. Maybe like we're siding with the Rashbam here, but maybe either for all four people who are exempt or at least the first three, the Torah cares about matters of anguish. The Torah cares about building, about planting, about raising a family, and those ideals are presented not only in theory, but indeed. We want people to go home and do those life processes because we care about those life processes. We don't just care about the battle and the army. Okay, now ready to move on to the next section, which is the rules of warfare. Mechamet Rashut and Mechamet Mitzvah. So here we have to define our terms. We did a little bit. But in the Torah's perspective here in this next section, it defines it a little differently. Kitzik Ravel Ir Lehilachem Aleha Vekarata Elala Shalom. Before you go out to battle, you should call out to the city and offer the city peace. Okay. If you look at Pasuk Tadvav, Kein ta'aseh l'chol ha'arim harechokot mimcha me'od, asher lo me'arei ha'goyim ha'elah heina. The Torah differentiates between two different types of battles. In this terminology found in this parak, milchamet reshut seems to refer to arim rechokot, cities that are far away from you. Perhaps when we're on the offensive to conquer more territory. But milchamet mitzvah, an obligatory war, is the wars fought against the arei ha'goyim ha'elah, the nations living in Israel, the seven nations of Canaan. Again, Mefarshim will broaden it to say that any mechametz would be any defensive war. The Rambam says, everyone says also as well, that mechametz would also include the battles against Amalek. So there's a debate, though, within this section about the first two psukim. The first two psukim say, whenever you go out to battle, you have to offer them peace. Vaya im shalom ta'ancha, if they do respond and they accept your peace, ufarchala, vaya koha'am hanim tzaba yu lecha lamas ve'abducha. And the whole nation now becomes your servants, and they pay you some sort of tax, perhaps the work tax. We actually see that with Shlomo HaMelech. The question is going to be is, who do we offer peace to? Do we offer peace to only when we're fighting these optional wars against Arim Rechokot, cities far away from us? Or do we offer peace even to the nations living in Israel, the Amei Canaan, in Mechamet Mitzvah? In these obligatory wars, are we allowed to offer peace? So Rashi, this is source number 9, says no, we're not allowed to offer peace to the nations living in Israel. Kitzik Rav El Ir, B'Mechamet Rishut HaKatzik Medaber. This first pasuk good, is only referring to an optional war. As it tells us later on, everything which I told you above in Pasuk 15 only refers to a Mechamet Rishut. So according to Rashi, a Mechamet Rishut, an optional war, you are allowed to offer peace. But an obligatory war, you're not allowed to offer peace. The Pesukim also describe what actually happens when we fight. And there's also a difference between who you're allowed to kill during an optional versus obligatory war. In an optional war, if the enemy refuses your peace, you're allowed to only kill the males. But in an obligatory war, again, you're not allowed to offer peace, and according to the Psukim, you have to kill everybody, men, women, and children. The Ramban, however, reads these Psukim very differently. And the Ramban feels that although Rashi was quoting the Sifri, the Ramban feels like that Rashi is not explaining the Midrash appropriately. The Ramban here, we'll start with line number 2. This is source number 10. Kasav HaRav Zemi Sifri. The Rav, meaning Rashi, quoted from the Midrash. Sheshaninu Sham Kilashon HaZeh. B'Melchamet HaRashi Shekatzav Medaber. He's quoting word for word from the Midrash, but he thinks Rashi is misunderstanding the Midrash. V'Hakavana L'Rabotinu B'Katuv Zeh. Here's what the rabbis really meant by what they said. Eino El Lomar Shehaparsha B'Sofa Techalek Ben Shnei HaMelchamot. Yes, the psukim will later on differentiate between Mechamet Mitzvah, Mechamet Rashut, namely, who you're allowed to kill in what type of war. Arim Rechokot, optional war, you're only allowed to kill the males. But in Mechamet Mitzvah, you are supposed to kill everybody. The Ramban says, but that distinction is only at the end of these psukim in section 2. But for offering peace, the Ramban writes, Aval Kriyat HaShalom, I feel the Mechamet Mitzvah. But Psukim Yudin Yudaf, where it tells you to offer peace, that applies to all wars. So the offering of peace applies to optional wars and mandatory wars. Every battle, any war the Jews fight, we must first offer the enemy an option of peace. If they refuse, then we have the differentiation between how we act, how we treat the enemy, depending on if it's an optional mandatory war. But every single battle must include offering a peace. The Ramban gives two proofs to this. He actually quotes that Moshe offered peace to Sichon, and God told Moshe, go fight Sichon. So how is Moshe later offering peace? God told him to fight. So Ramban explains, Moshe's not violating God's will, but here we see an example that even an obligatory war must first have the Jews offering that nation and out, offering them peace conditions. And then furthermore, as further support, this is the end of the Ramban, quotes Gemara Yerushalmi that Yehoshua sent letters to all the nations living in Israel before he came in, offering them either to stay and have peace, to leave, or to fight. And same thing, Yehoshua offered nations living in Israel, the Amei Canaan, Mechamet Mitzvah, an option for peace. Why would we offer peace? Because here we see this Horus value that we want to avoid war at all costs, and that every battle, we try to avoid it. We first want to give the enemy an option of an out, of first forming peace with us without having to go to war. Just as an add-on, the Ramban sees there's a different difference between Mechamet Mitzvah and Mechamet Rishut. So again, Rashi saw it as you offer peace, you not offer peace. The Ramban sees it as you offer peace to both, but the conditions of peace are different between cities that are close, cities that are far away. And he actually bases on the Sifri, this last line, the last two lines of the Ramban. V'amru b'Sifri, ha imasu tshuva ein nehargim b'shivat adamim hu. If the nations living in Israel, if it's a Mechamet Mitzvah, specifically the nations living in Israel, if they do tshuva, if they are no longer following polytheism, then there is no right to kill them. We wouldn't kill them. What the Ramban is telling us that part of the condition for peace must be with the nations living in Israel is that they must abandon Avodah Zarah. That's not the same case for nations living far away. And the reason is because the Pesukim explain, we don't want them to tempt us and be a mechshol, be a stumbling block for the Jewish people. That's why we have these, what seems like these very barbaric rules of killing everybody. It's not because we hate their race, but it's because we can't have them influence us and keep Avodah Zarah in the land. If they don't keep Avodah Zarah, then we have no reason to kill them, and there would be no obligation to obliterate them. It's simply because of their actions of idolatry. If they abandon idolatry, they can certainly live in peace with the Jewish people. So our conclusion of the second section is that we understand that offering peace is a value that precedes any war, and includes, like the speech of the officers to the nation in the previous parsha, a subdued protest against war. But the previous protest was directed towards the suffering of the Jewish soldier, or the Jewish camp. This protest is to avoid the suffering of the enemy. Spilling of blood of the enemy should be avoided if possible. Now let's look at our third section. Our third section is about not cutting down fruit trees during times of battle. Kitat sur al ir yamim rabim, this is Pasuk Yotet. When you besiege a city for many days, liachem ala letafsa, you want to conquer the city, lo tashpit etza, do not cut down its trees, lindoach alav garza, wielding your axe, kimimeno tochal, because you eat from these trees. V'lto lo tichrot, so therefore don't cut them down. Ki ha'adam eitz asadza, lavo v'panacha b'matzor. That's a very difficult phrase to translate. We'll just translate it literally, because man is like a tree of the field who goes before you in time of siege. And then the last passage tells us only if you need to cut down trees to help you in fighting the siege, you should cut down non-fruit-bearing trees. What are the two reasons given in these pesukim for why you should not cut down trees? So there seems to be two separate reasons. The first reason is in Pasuk Yotet. Ki mimeno tochal. You need to eat from fruit trees, therefore don't cut the fruit trees down. The second reason is that weird enigmatic phrase of ki ha'adam eitz ha'asadah, because man is a tree of the field. Let's look at each phrase separately. What does it mean, ki mimeno tochal? Simplistically, the Rashbam explains it to us. This is source number 11. Ki mimeno tochal, sha'arei tzrichim lecha l'machal. You need these trees for food. Lachar shatispos ha'ir b'tziyah shalcha. Because after you conquer the city, these fruit-bearing trees will be yours. And therefore, you're going to need to eat from them. So don't cut down what eventually will feed you. Ramban develops and explains what would be the rationale for someone to destroy fruit trees.
So look at the Ramban source 12. Im kein peirosh ha-parsha l'adatam shehazi ratora lo tashrit et etza l'chrod otam derech hashchata shelo l'tzorech matzor kimin haga machano. The Torah is telling you, don't cut down fruit trees, don't be destructive during battle just to be destructive. This is customarily, this is a common practice during times of war. Why? Why do people do this during war? Because the enemy is going to destroy all the surrounding parts of the city because perhaps he wants to conquer the city. It helps him conquer the city. And I think what the Ramban is describing is a famed war tactic called the scorched earth policy, where a nation will destroy surrounding areas so that they can easily defeat the enemy. So they, you know, they starve the enemy. Which I think what's interesting about this Ramban, though, and perhaps it's Horace telling us, is what's really going on in the psyche of the soldier when they're practicing the scorched earth policy? What are they thinking? I think what they're thinking is, I want to hurt the other side, but I'm not sure I'm going to win. Right? If I was sure I was going to win this battle, then I wouldn't scorch the earth because what's the problem? I'm hurting myself. When I conquer the city, now I have nothing to live off of. Right? I know some famous examples, like, you know, like the Russians and Napoleon. The Russians burned all these things, and they burned their fields. Notice they also killed a lot of their own people in doing so, but that did not allow Napoleon to conquer them. But if someone really believed that God was going to be on their side and they were going to win, they wouldn't destroy everything in their path because they're going to need that later on. They're going to need that to eat. So I almost think that this prohibition is not just because the Torah doesn't want us to be destructive to be destructive, but the Torah is telling us that being destructive, in the sense, shows a lack of faith in God. That you're not sure, you're not confident you're going to win the battle, and therefore you're thinking, let me hurt them and let me hurt myself, because I don't know who's going to win. But we don't need to be destructive, because we know that God's going to win the war for us, the Ramban continues. So both the Rashbam and the Ramban explain that kimei meno tochal is don't destroy these trees because you're going to need these trees in the future. You're guaranteed you're going to win. Don't destroy what's going to be your food source for the future. How do we explain now the phrase ki adam eitz hasadeh? This phrase is difficult. Unglis translated as adding the word lo. Man is not a tree of the field. Rashi reads it as a rhetorical question. Is man like a tree of the field that it could go and be part of a siege? Meaning, men are, trees are these innocent bystanders. Don't, trees can't defend themselves. They can't protect themselves like people in the siege can. Therefore, leave the trees alone. The Ibn Ezra rejects these readings as a grammar and feels like you can never add a lo to a pasuk because that would change the whole meaning. You can't just do that. If the Torah meant no, the Torah told you no. So the Ibn Ezra says, this phrase is very similar to the beginning part. It's telling you that man survives, survival depends on fruit. Therefore, don't destroy the fruit trees because man needs fruit to survive. The difference between the Ibn Ezra and, say, the Rashi or Prodi is, are there two reasons for why we can't destroy trees, or is there only one reason? For Ibn Ezra, there's only one reason. Don't destroy fruit trees because you need fruit trees to survive. But for Rashi, it's don't destroy fruit trees because you need them to survive, but also because they're innocent bystanders. They didn't do anything wrong to you, and they can't defend themselves. So perhaps the nafka mina between Rashi and Ibn Ezra means, do we care about trees, or do we just care about people? And for Rashi, we do care about the environment. And the Torah tells you, don't be destructive just to be destructive. We care about things. We care about other creatures, about plant life. In fact, the Rambam learns all the laws of Baal Tashrit from these psukim. There's a prohibition against being destructive just for the sake of being destructive. Clogging up a well just to clog up a well. Cutting down a tree for no reason. Destroying kalim, vessels, clothing for no purpose, all falls under this prohibition of not destroying fruit trees. Not to be destructive during just to be destructive, which is such a war mentality. During war, we know it. People just destroy things because they can. And the Torah is telling us during our battles not to be destructive. Only do what you need to do for the sake of that battle. Don't go beyond that. So therefore, we see another protest against a warlike mentality, right? That this is a protest not directed against people, but about the perversion of character traits which war brings upon. A person who is righteous by nature, don't destroy just to destroy. So conclusion of our three sections, as Rav David Tzvi Hoffman put it, is these three war topics all present a protest against war. The pre-war speeches, we see that we value life at home, protect our own individual soldiers' lives, that the army is not the end-all be-all of everything. In the second section, we offer peace, we value the enemy's life, we don't want to kill just for no reason, and that every battle would first, we'd offer peace to the enemy. And this third section, the fruit trees, not to destroy, just to be destructive. Trying to change the war mentality that is so common. The Torah presents laws of war within this dichotomy, that war is a reality. Key each section of these is what these things will happen. You will go out to war, you will have to kill, and you will besiege nations. But it should not define who we are. We have to fight, but at our core, we are not warriors who view war as the end-all and be-all of our Jewish existence. And that's Moshe's and God's message to the Jewish people on the eve of their battles. Yes, go out and fight, but don't let war define who we are as Jewish people. Thank you.